So, Susan, apparently Ben follows the Mike Pence rule of he won't be in a room alone with a woman without his wife.
Right. That's why we are witness.
Yes, because Tammy is out of town, and so Ben refused to be.
Well, he takes an extreme position where he can't be in the room with men or women. He just, if his wife's not there, he can't be in the room. Which, you know, Mike Pence is right. Better safe than sorry.
It really is a better safe than sorry situation. I think it's probably kept Mike Pence out of a lot of predicaments, and it's probably a good rule for him to follow now, especially. I, however, do not follow this room, which is why I'm happy to be in a room full of ladies.
Just ladies this week.
Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the On the Edge of Our Seats edition. I'm Shane Harris, lady friend reporter. I'm in a room full of some of my favorite women journalists,
thinkers, gal pals.
Essayists, my gal pals. This is like if I had a party, like a gal pal party at the house, and we recorded a podcast.
We should do that.
We should totally do that. We have liquor here if anybody wants it, just so we're clear.
And you might need it.
But I'm here with my good friend Susan Hennessy, as always, and Quinta Jurassic of Lawfare. Welcome back, Quinta.
Hello, hello.
And Nancy Youssef, my buddy.
Hi,
from
darling.
How far back do we go? We go back so
50 years.
50 years back when we were young vampires.
That's right.
That's right. Nancy Youssef of the Wall Street Journal, formerly of the Daily Beast, where I know you from. We were talking about this on the way in. You were one of the first guests of the podcast when we first started.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Such a wonderfully long wait. It's been great.
Ben was there for that, but this is before he adopted the Pence role, so it was okay for
him
to be
alone. Or if Tammy was there, then that's...
No, she wasn't there.
Oh, you subject Tammy.
Yeah, it was just the three of us. It was very pre-Pence. Maybe we'll be living in a Pence world very soon. Who knows? A lot of things can happen. We're recording this podcast. We're just going to go ahead and say at 2:15 p.m. on Wednesday, April 11th. So just in case the world has shifted anytime after this podcast comes out, know that we're giving you our best read on history as it's happening. On the podcast this week, federal authorities launch raids on the home and office of President Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg testifies before Congress, and the U.S. prepares for possible military action against Syria. So let's start with the main news of the week that has everyone kind of on the edge of our seats because we're wondering what the president's reaction might be to this, but we'll talk about that in a bit. But the Southern District of New York agents there and acting under a warrant from the Southern District launched raids on Michael Cohen's office, his personal residence, and a hotel where he was staying with his family while his home was under renovation. And as we understand it, they were looking for records about payments that Michael Cohen made to two women who have said that they had affairs with the president. And the information appears to also touch on attorney-client information, so communications that Cohen may have had with President Trump, possibly before he was elected. Susan, so this is a huge political deal, and we're going to talk about that too. But let's just start quickly with the legal significance of this and kind of put this in context, both in terms of what it means that a search warrant was executed on the office and residence of an attorney, much less the attorney of the President of the United States, and where this fits into our evolving understanding of the Russia probe.
So I think there's a few things, and I'll start by sort of commending a piece that Ben wrote that sort of lays out some of the implications for this earlier this week. So he's here with us in spirit and blog post, if not in physical form. But look, this is significant, one, because Michael Cohen is incredibly close to the president. It's also significant because Michael Cohen is a lawyer, and because this is – the search was for related to sort of client services information. And so we can read a number of things into the execution of that warrant and the fact that it was signed off on, it tells us that there's something really significant. So first and foremost, you know, for a search warrant to be executed, it has to have a probable cause standard. But this is one thing that Ben flagged. We can be sure it's a hell of a lot more than that, right? This is so politically sensitive that, like, even if you said, well, probable cause isn't that strong of a standard, like, we can be absolutely certain that this is a rock solid warrant application. No one would go out on a limb. So just sort of as a political matter of sort of prudential judgment, it says a lot that they're getting this close to the president. It says
and
a lot.
And kind of suggests that they already have a lot of evidence already before they went and raided his house and his office.
Right. It's really bad news for Michael Cohen. It's also really bad news for President Trump. I mean, like, we are getting into kind of the inner circle stuff. The other thing that's significant isn't just sort of Michael Cohen's personal closeness with the president, which raises the political optics. It's the fact that he is a lawyer. So there's something that Trump is sort of like, attorney-client privilege is dead, and is really focused on the inviolability of that particular relationship. It is significant because the Justice Department has particular rules and protections governing searches that are executed against lawyers because there is attorney-client privilege, because you want to be really, really careful, really sensitive about recognizing this privilege. It's best understood as sort of an extension of a Fifth Amendment privilege, right? So if you have the right not to incriminate yourself and you need to have the right to have sort of clear and candid communications with your lawyer, then your lawyer also has to, have that protection. So it's incredibly, we can read a lot into it. We know that certain procedures had to have been signed off for this search warrant to have been executed. So I think all in all, it's bad news for the president. It's sort of, it's highly consequential. Now, I think there is still an open question about what exactly it means for the Russia investigation and how closely tied it is. So there's been sort of reporting that Cohen is being investigated for bank fraud, and because the warrant also included documents related to these Stormy Daniels payments, also Cohen gave
and
an interview.
And Karen McDougal too, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. And Cohen gave an interview, I think, to CNN where he referenced the Stormy Daniels payment. So that could have, like, there's lots of hints that that's what this is, what this is related to. So there are, people are using the term referral. This was a referral from Robert Mueller's team. There are two, like, explanations for what that referral might mean. One is that in the course of investigating, Mueller has come across a different crime, right? A crime that he thinks is sort of outside his purview. And this happens in the Justice Department all the time, right? If you're investigating for, drug crimes and you come across evidence of, bank fraud or child exploitation or something else, you make the referral to the appropriate part, and then they do an investigation of that crime. So there's one form of referral that, Mueller has gotten to something, he's seen something that Michael Cohen might have done, and so he's referred the case over, and now the Southern District of New York, which executed the search warrant, specifically their public corruption office, and so he's handed a chunk of the investigation over. The other explanation, and this is one that former SDNY United States Attorney Preet Bharara has sort of flagged, and that's that the SDNY is essentially functioning as a taint team here. Mm. And so the way that this works is because attorney-client privilege is such an important thing, one way you might sort of get around the thorniest issues is that you would have the search executed by one group of people. They would review all the materials that they're bringing in for privilege, right? So they're looking at, all right, here's clearly privileged materials, here's non-privileged materials, here's what we think we can see. Then what they're going to do is they're going to take the materials that are determined to be not privileged, either because they fall within the crime fraud exception or some other reason. They're going to hand only those files over to a different team, right? In this case, Mueller's team, so that team can move forward with a prosecution. And there's no question about whether or not, well, you saw privileged material and now you're using it, right? They aren't going to have to sort of make that showing in standard. We haven't sort of seen enough to make that assessment yet. So sort of two possible questions hanging out there. Then there's sort of the big giant elephant in the room, and that's that Trump clearly had a very, very strong reaction to this. This is really getting into the inner circle. And so what does it mean for the future of the Mueller investigation, for Justice Department officials? Right, sort of that's the like dot, 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 what happens next.
Right. So, Quinta, let me just kind of kick that over to you. So there's obviously, as Susan laid out, there's these kinds of, there's some questions over exactly the particulars of what the warrant was and who was executing it, but clearly pretty significant legal action, not great for Cohen. President Trump wasted no time in responding to this, as we've discussed. So let's talk about then now the political moment in which we find ourselves, where I think we are all sort of kind of waiting on pins and needles for what the president is going to do. I mean, he has not overtly said that he plans to fire Rod Rosenstein or to move on Bob Mueller, although he has talked about just in the past day or so, I think, in comments about how people have said he could do it. The White House has said he believes he has the authority to do it. So it seems like now we find ourselves kind of, you know, I feel anyway, maybe you tell me if I'm wrong, like we're sort of getting close to the precipice here that I think is the moment that we've all envisioned that the president could take some kind of action to try and stymie the investigation. And do you think we're there? Do you think that Michael Cohen being raided is a significant enough trigger to compel the president to do it?
Yeah, I would say so Jack Goldsmith had a really good piece in Lawfare this morning, basically talking about this sort of cycles of response to Trump. And Jack's understanding is basically that it goes like this, you know, that Trump gets bent out of sorts about something and says he's going to fire Mueller, or he's going to fire Sessions, or he's going to fire Rosenstein. People panic. Then the Republicans kind of say, it would be a very bad idea if you did that. And Trump kind of backs off, and then the whole thing begins again. My view of it is that there's kind of another step before that, which is that there's this lull where Republicans say, after Trump calms down, they say, well, we don't need to do anything because he's not going to fire Mueller, because he didn't fire Mueller last time. That, you know, there's been this legislation to protect the special counsel that we can actually discuss the merits are a much more complicated question. But the idea, I think, is to serve as kind of a brushback pitch to the president. And every time we enter the lull period, Republicans just say, you know, well, he didn't fire Mueller. You know, he's not going to fire Mueller. I don't see why we have to do anything. And then Trump gets, you know,
it's all good.
Trump feels bolder. Yeah. He gets bent out of sorts about something. He gets angry and the whole thing begins again. And what worries me is that it just seems like we're sort of dancing back and forth, you know, one step forward, one step back, as you say, on the edge of the cliff. Like, there is not a lot of slack here. And my concern is that over time, first off, that we don't know how much of a rational actor Trump really is, that he could get mad enough to not heed those brushback pitches because they haven't really been substantial. It's mostly been sort of signaling rather than
anything.
He's
kind of gauging that the Republicans will support him.
Exactly. And now, and the problem is that if he looks at it and says, you know, we've gone through this like 20 times, they've never done anything other than say, well, Mr. President, I think that would be a very bad idea. You know, to hell with it. I'm just going to go do it.
Right.
And so because he seems so angry in response to the Cohen news, both on Twitter and in the reporting that's been done, and because this is the umpteenth round of this cycle, that does make me worried that we're headed towards something very bad.
And I think, too, that like that he sees in his mind a difference between firing Rosenstein and firing Mueller, and that he thinks that firing Rosenstein is somehow not as severe as firing Mueller, putting aside how you would actually go about, quote-unquote, firing Mueller. But Nancy, let me ask you, because you spend a lot of your time, too. I mean, you are covering him primarily in his role as commander-in-chief, but this really gets at these questions of temperament and judgment and, you know, how he responds to facts on the ground and changing situations, which, of course, any commander-in-chief does. But maybe talk a little about that and then your kind of reaction of where we are right now, too.
Well, it's funny. As you guys were talking, I was thinking about Jeff Sessions, because there was a time when Jeff Sessions bore the brunt of the blame for this investigation, and now it seems to have shifted to Rod Rosenstein.
Right, he's the new whipping boy.
Well, right. I mean, there's a reticence to sort of, for some, obviously, because Mueller's doing the investigation. So it's interesting how these reactions sort of play out. I think for a military, you know, the biggest challenge is military depends on structure above all else. Mm-hmm. Structure and how orders are given, structures in terms of how things are run. And I think the way it sort of bleeds into the military is the loss of expectation of a clear command from the commander-in-chief, right?
And a consistent one, yeah.
Right. I mean, for in other parts of government, people have learned about the president's view on things through Twitter. But when it's a military and it's something, last July we heard about the call to ban transgender troops. Remember, the military is an organization of 2 million people. You can't have opaque, unclear personnel policies with that many people. So these outbursts or tweets, I think, are received one way in a civilian world. In a military world, it's just unsettling because it is the basis of is command and control. There's no other way to manage that many people.
And I think you're good, Susan. I think that that's fascinating because it sort of gets at, you know, we're all sitting here trying to figure out what is he going to do about this raid on Michael Cohen. And to some extent, we don't really know because he's incredibly hard to discern.
Yeah. I mean, I think this gets back into sort of like, how dumb does Trump think we are, right? And that's right.
See, I don't think he has a theory of mind. That's the problem.
It's sort of like it really, really reminds me of sort of the Air Force One statement, the explanation of Don Jr.'s meeting with the Russians in Trump Tower, which is like, it's about adoptions, as if every thinking person wouldn't understand that that was about the Magnitsky Act, right? Like, they're too cute by half about everything. They think that if they, like, oh, we've found a way that, you know, we can get away with this and no one's going to call us on it. You know, we're going to, you know, I'm not going to fire Mueller. Everyone's always talking about firing Mueller, but I can fire Rod Rosenstein, and people, you know, people won't be able to sort of make that connection, as if it's not entirely obvious sort of what's happening here. The thing I'm really struck by is Trump's fury over recusals, right? His notion that recusals, which really aren't discretionary, right? There are Justice Department rules about when you are conflicted and have to recuse from something. But sort of his sense that recusal is somehow, you know, you're giving up power. It's an expression of disloyalty. I just think that this is sort of, it's another insight into sort of how his mind works of, you know, the instance in which ordinary people would understand a recusal is necessary in order to protect the institutional integrity. That's the exact thing that Trump thinks that you should not be recusing on, right? That's where you have the most power. That's right. Where you can sort of exert your will. It's almost as if he doesn't recognize that it's like the definition of corruption.
But in a business world where he's operated most of his career, Michael Cohen was able to rise precisely because he was loyal, precisely because he would take the hits and do whatever was needed. So I think, you know, we often think of like businessmen and women are great for government. Government's not a business. And it's not just because one's looking for a profit and one's not. But one operates very differently. In a business world, that makes a lot of sense. You're in a very cutthroat world. And here's a guy who's said publicly in interviews that he was going to be loyal to the bitter end. And so I think that's where the disconnect is. Because in the business world, I don't think there is recusals. And I think that's the loss in translation that comes down here. Because in Washington, that's a very normal thing, that that boundaries have to be, our whole system of government is built on boundaries and response and honoring the lanes in which you're legally allowed to operate in.
I mean, just quickly on that point, I do think, you know, federal investigations have a really clarifying function in terms of things like loyalty. And Michael Cohen can talk a lot about loyalty, but I think it will be really interesting to see the extent of that loyalty when it has serious repercussions for him, for his family, right? I mean, if he is in as much trouble as he appears to be, we might get a better sense of sort of what the extent of his loyalty is. And I think that actually might be part of why Trump is so panicked here.
Because he knows Michael Cohen will totally squeal on him.
So there's another aspect of the loyalty thing too, which is that the Southern District of New York, the person currently serving as interim U.S. attorney, there isn't yet a Senate-confirmed U.S. attorney, is none other than Jeffrey Berman, who was personally interviewed for the job by Trump, which is not something that presidents usually do, caused a pretty big outcry at the time, you know, suggesting that Berman might have been compromised by that conversation. It's obviously notable that Trump chose to interview the person who might be serving as U.S. attorney for the jurisdiction in which Trump Tower is located. Clearly, that didn't help him here. Berman recused from the case. He removed himself entirely. Hard to say whether that's because of this conversation or something else. But if Trump had a vision of, you know, Justice Department leadership as going to heed to him by having these sort of personal conversations, it seems like in this case, the bureaucracy actually is a step ahead.
I do wonder if Trump will take that lesson, you know, right? So if he fires Rosenstein, if he fires the FBI director, right? We've seen Devin Nunes on like the Sunday shows suggesting that that Ray might be on the chopping block again. Whether or not he learns this lesson that he shouldn't fill open positions with sort of like establishment figures, right? every single time that there's been an opening and Trump has been convinced to put like a Republican, but sort of a mainstream Republican, that's come back to haunt him because they follow the institutional rules like recusal. So I wonder if this isn't going to incentivize him to essentially push the limits of putting, you know, increasingly ridiculous people. So imagine somebody like, you know, Michael Cohen for attorney general, right? People who he understands are going to be as disrespectful of the institutions. I mean, thus far, sort of the primary check on that has been his own staff and, of course, like the confirmation process. But whether or not he's going to try and push the limit with that, especially if in the near future there are high profile vacancies that he's going to be able to fill.
We're going to move on to the next segment. Before we do, I just want to note breaking news that just came across, because by the time you hear this podcast, there will probably have been a lot of discussion on it. But the New York Times is reporting that FBI agents who raided the office of Michael Cohen were also seeking all records related to the Access Hollywood tape, in which Mr. Trump was heard making vulgar comments about women. This is according to three people who've been briefed on the contents of the search warrant. It also sought evidence of whether Michael Cohen tried to suppress damaging information about Mr. Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign. Not clear what role, if any, Mr. Cohen played regarding the tape, which was made public a month before the election. But the Times reports the fact that the agents were seeking documents related to the tape reveals a new front in the investigation into Mr. Cohen that is being led by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan. So we don't know a ton right now, but you'll know more by the time you hear this, future world. All right, let's stay in the present, or at least the recent past for now. Speaking as somebody who was on the edge of his seat, Mark Zuckerberg.
The edge of a 4-inch cushion.
Yeah, Mark Zuckerberg on the edge of a very cushion
seat. Did he need a booster seat?
Yeah. Oh, it so might just cute. Be, I mean, he was in that chair for a long time. He might have just needed a little comfort.
Wasn't like a, okay, all right. Well, Mark Zuckerberg testifying before a rare joint session of Congress. 44 senators, I believe, were at this hearing, which is, one pointed out, which was basically half of the Senate. There to answer questions, obviously, about Facebook's role in the election, how it was compromised and used, maybe not compromised, actually used as designed by Russian trolls and others to influence opinions, to put out news stories, propaganda, etc. And obviously the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which we've talked a lot about. Quinta, I mean, I'm curious, like, it's just a first order question, like, how did he do? I mean, there was a huge amount of expectation for Zuckerberg in this moment, and I think we weren't going to settle any disputes at this hearing. And to some extent, this was really about the question of his performance in this particular context. So let's start with, how do you think he did?
I think he actually did well. I mean, we should also say, again, saying that we don't know currently everything that's happening, that Zuckerberg has been testifying this morning before a House committee. But yesterday's Senate hearing, I think there was a lot of desire, certainly on my part, for a kind of catharsis, you know, a kind of walloping of him, you know, have you no sense of decency, all that. Right. That was very much not what happened. I've seen multiple reporters comment that it had the feel of kind of the nephew pulled in to like help set up the computer. And there is a lot of truth to that. Most notably, there is a moment where, you know, someone was asking Zuckerberg a question that just didn't make any sense. And they sort of reformulated it so that it did make some sense. And Zuckerberg said, oh, OK, which just sounds like, oh, OK, your Wi-Fi was off.
Yeah, right.
Now I can help you.
Did you try the power button?
Exactly.
Did you
unplug it and then plug it in again? And look, it's easy to make fun of the Senate for not being prepared. I think that having 44 senators on the panel to question him is a ridiculous proposition, especially with something this complicated. But the fact that they really don't seem to understand what Facebook is and how to think about it, I think points to something really serious, which is that no one really understands what Facebook is.
Well, and even to some extent, I mean, I'd be curious what, you know, Susan and Nancy think of this. I'm watching it, and aside from kind of some of his sort of robotic responses, and he had clearly been prepped like within an inch of his young life for this hearing.
Oh, he had that opening statement memorized. Oh,
and it was like a lot of, Senator, yes.
There's Senator, also Joel Kaplan, who's the VP of policy, behind him, was like, making faces.
There was a lot of mugging behind him. You could see him
reacting to what Zuckerberg was saying. Like, two thumbs that up. Was oh, weird. No, okay, he didn't that do
was
that. Weird.
There was a lot of mugging. Like, it's like, you are on TV, sir. But I'm curious, like, to your point, I thought what was sort of fascinating about this was precisely as Quintus said. I mean, you're listening to, like, these senators who I frankly, you know, maybe a little bit more of a dig on their staff for not helping them kind of form more articulated questions and kind of get at what the hell are we trying to ask here. But even, like, with Zuckerberg talking to them, it was this sense of, like, I'm not sure anybody really completely has a great agreed-upon definition of what Facebook is. And I think one of the frustrations for lawmakers may have been that to some extent that's a little bit by design at Facebook, right? I mean, it is there constantly iterating and innovating, and they're doing all these things that to a lawmaker, I think it sort of maybe is a little bit mind-bending that this company operates in part by, you know, challenging convention and being willing to fail and trying all kinds of new stuff. And maybe we're this today and maybe we're that tomorrow. And they are perfectly comfortable living to some degree in that world of ambiguity. Although, as Zuckerberg make it very clear, like, they completely understand what their business model is. That's a different thing. But the it feels like they were sometimes having a different set of conversations and trying to agree on what the hell are we talking about here.
So I think that's a reflection of, right, this is the first time Mark Zuckerberg has testified in front of Congress. And so there are lots of different issues that have sort of built up over time. And I think Congress recognizes this is probably the last time they're going to get a sort of a shot at him in that kind of public setting for a long time. And so some of, like, the back and forth is just, hey, I don't care so much about this Cambridge Analytica thing. I don't care about what you're I care about sort of my issue, right, this thing. And I think it's especially jarring whenever a senator might have sort of had an issue that has been mooted, right, or sort of changed. It's like we're picking Facebook scandals from different eras, and each sort of senator is asking questions related to that. And so I agree there was a disjointedness, but I think you would have seen the same disjointedness if, you know, Bill Gates had testified in 2000, right? Like, it's everybody wants a piece.
But do you think you would have heard the same disjointedness if they testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee instead, which has been steeped in this stuff and would have very specific questions?
I think that part of it is that the Republican, well, not all Republican senators, a handful of Republican senators, Ben Sasse, Ted Cruz, were concerned about this question of Facebook censoring conservative content or not allowing it to spread to the extent that it should have. I'll put "should" in air quotes there because there's really no objective measure. Whereas the Democrats were not concerned about that. The Republicans were kind of concerned about over-regulation leading to censorship of voices of their constituents, and the Democrats weren't. So there is a kind of double aspect going on there that might have been present in the Senate Intelligence Committee, because I don't actually think it's not just, you know, censoring conservative voices. That actually points to a real problem about what it means if we do over censor.
I was just going to say, you know, for me as an outside observer watching it, I was struck by this vicious cycle of we need to regulate more because it's a monopoly, but we don't really understand it. And as someone who's covered the implications of Facebook's reach around the world, it just struck me as a little late because the impact has been profound. I mean, it was a contributing factor to Arab Spring. It's shaping how people talk around the world. And even as you talk about regulating, we're also conceding that it might be a monopoly. And so how do you pull that back when the impact has been so profound, not only just with Cambridge Analytica, but really how the world interacts? Yeah. It's become a critical tool, especially in developed areas, for people to reach out and bypass government or bypass censorship. So it's just interesting to me, Lindsey Graham's exchange with Zuckerberg when he talks about, are you a monopoly or not? And then Zuckerberg says, we do need to be regulated. Well, what kind of regulation? Well, we can't tell you what kind of regulation. It just kept going in a vicious circle. So
we'll be happy to work with you.
So I think this is an important point, and it's actually something that I do not understand why this is the scandal that has taken hold, right? There's been all kinds of sort of fuffles about Facebook, but something about, like, this particular scandal.
You mean the Cambridge Analytica thing?
The Cambridge Analytica and the apps that allowed the scraping of the friend's profile. Like, really, this thing that, like, they resolved in 2015 and sort of has already been reported for anybody who's paying attention to the FTC, you know, consent agreement stuff. Like, there's sort of an irrationality to it of, you know, this is, for some reason, this is what's captured the public's imagination. This is what captured sort of Congress's imagination. And so I do think that whenever we, you know, you heard Zuckerberg say that regulation is probably inevitable. And I do think that they're starting to understand that. But the particular type of regulation is going to be driven by whatever it is, like whatever feature is the thing that has sort of taken a hold in the public.
Right.
And that's not necessarily related to the most important issues or the issues that are even most amenable to regulation.
Right. How do you regulate how people take information years after they've gotten used to this model, how they interact with each other, what they consider privacy, what how they hand over information, what they understand about what they're posting? It just, you know, I think of the sort of apex of Facebook and its impact in terms of Arab Spring, and it just had such a profound shaping of how information is exchanged that you're right to talk about Cambridge Analytica. It's very important, but the subsect in terms of the consequence was that there's a platform now that is fundamentally changing how we take in information.
Right. Quinto, sorry, go ahead.
Whenever we sort of talk about his, you know, evaluating his performance, I'm really reminded whenever I was a summer associate at a law firm, so just like a law student there for the summer, I was really stressed out about doing a good job until finally somebody told me, like, you actually can't do a good job. You can only, like, not screw up.
That's true.
It's like, don't screw anything up. You've done a great job. That's like the apex of the achievement. It's not possible for you to like write a really amazing brief or something. Like, you're an idiot. You're a law student. You don't know anything. I feel like Mark Zuckerberg, it was the exact same thing. Like, there was no way that he was going to go and do like an amazing job and win people over and, you know, have this charm offensive. It was like he just had to not screw up. And that is sort of a resounding success. And by that metric, you know, barring some sort of meltdown that we aren't seeing because we're working. Recording this podcast right now, he wildly succeeded only by not making things worse for them. Yeah.
Quinta, why do you think the Cambridge Analytica has captured the imagination?
So I will register a note of dissent here. I actually think that it's totally true that most of the information about Cambridge Analytica we already knew, right? Which I think as
even before the New York Times story.
Yes, absolutely. Which is one of the reasons why it's sort of confusing, why this is important. I would argue that it's significant because it is a sort of window into seeing all these different dynamics that are really at the center of the question of what happened during the 2016 election. Not only how Russia might have leveraged social media tools, but as Nancy says, how we've changed to exist on this platform, which is something new and different, that there's something in the way that news is consumed, that algorithms determine what is shown. There's been a lot written on how there's a potentially radicalizing effect. You know, if you click on things about how Donald Trump is great, you start getting things about how Alex Jones is great. That the way the ads can play into that. And then there's the privacy aspect as well. So what I think it is that there was this platform that sort of changed the way we existed in the world. And then suddenly it turned out very bluntly that was a huge liability in society as a whole. And now everyone is having to come to terms with that suddenly in a much sort of blunter way than we have thought about it previously, even though these questions of privacy and, you know, tracking across platforms have been present.
Okay, speaking of things and people getting fired, cruise missiles. Nancy, obviously the other big question on the White House's plate right now.
Meanwhile, in other news.
Is whether or not the U.S. is going to take any military action in response to the chemical weapons attack in Syria, what's the death count now on that? I believe it's 40? So,
yes, and 500 affected.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So not the first time we've seen the Assad regime use chemical weapons against civilians. But this was, I believe, in one of the last sort of rebel holdout areas around Damascus. So talk to us about what you know in terms of kind of where the thinking is on this right now. I mean, I think we're anticipating there will be some response. Maybe you'll correct me if that's wrong. But what is the thinking about how to respond? And I guess the ultimate question is, you know, what do we hope to gain by doing that?
Well, that's a really important question, and the last one in particular. If I could just set it up briefly. So as you mentioned, the Assad regime has used chemical weapons in the past. The area that was hit is called Douma, which is just outside of Damascus. And the reason it was hit and the way it was hit suggests that the regime decided that rather than go block by block, it would use a mix of chlorine and sarin to try to mask its responsibility in this and make it harder for the international community to determine who was responsible for this attack as a sort of brutal way to get one of the major groups there, Jaish al-Islam, to leave and therefore move its control over a wider swath outside the capital. And it worked, because after that chemical attack, which targeted hospitals in an effort to affect the maximum number of people, including people hiding in their basements, Jaish al-Islam members got on their buses and left. So this has been a red line, the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime. And a year ago, and this happened on the one-year anniversary of the U.S. strike in Syria, the U.S. did this thing, which was basically a messaging strike. They dropped 59 Tomahawk missiles into Sharat, which was the airfield from which they thought last year's strike happened, and took out the runway and some planes. The runway and the base was operational within days. So the feeling is that that message didn't get through because we're now dealing with a far bigger attack on civilians a year later. And so you now have a U.S. military and administration contemplating strikes, again, at either regime targets or even Russian targets to try to, from the words of U.S. officials, cripple their ability to conduct such strikes. Now, there are a couple challenges. These strikes were launched from helicopters. We're talking about hitting airfields. Does that really curtail it? They have Russian support. What happens if the U.S. were to hit Russian bases or kill Russian troops or Iranian forces? Would the Israelis do something independently because they see the use of chemical weapons as an existential threat to them? It gets pretty complicated. But your question is a key one, and one we haven't really had explained thus far, which is, what is the goal? Is it a retaliatory strike? Is it one that eliminates their air power altogether? We haven't really gotten that explanation. Instead, we got a tweet from Trump that really kind of telegraphed to the Syrian regime that something was coming. And so militarily, the USS Donald Cook is the destroyer of the region. There's an expectation that the French and the British would participate. There are subs in the region. It's not clear whether they would use manned aircraft because the Russians have ability to sort of guard and launch counterattacks, if you will, on aircraft. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of ambiguity to it. But the not long and short of it is, this will be more devastating because the feeling is that the messaging strike didn't get through, that this time it has to have a crippling effect. And I would just add that this all comes days after the administration announced that it was getting out of Syria. And so it's an interesting dilemma for the U.S. military, because there are many wars going on in Syria. And the one the U.S. military is primarily focused on is on the eastern side of the country against the Islamic State. This attack was against extremist elements on the western side of the state in a part of the war that the U.S. military hasn't been involved in. So I think for military planners and those who follow this closely, in a matter of days, this went from the war we were going to wind down to the one we're going to respond to in a completely different way, to a completely different threat.
And do you think that that's by accident, in the sense that, what I mean is, did the Assad regime take this opportunity to gas these people because the president had announced that we're getting out, and had really done it in this quite sudden way that, you know, I know from our reporting, your reporting, I mean, took all of his advisors by surprise. It's not even clear that the military understands the timeline they're on, but everybody seems to think it's like 6 months and we're out of here. Is that, do you think that had something to do with Assad pushing that button, so to speak, and saying, yeah.
So I'll give you two explanations, okay, and I'll let you, dear listeners, decide, because I literally go back and forth every day. So on one hand, it's one big coincidence that this would happen when it did, right? After the announcement, on the day that the U.S. did a strike a year ago, one could argue that the U.S. had already signaled that they weren't going to be in Syria anyway, well before the announcements by the administration, that by U.S. actions, that it wasn't going to get involved. It wasn't going to really confront Assad's grip on the country. Okay, so in that sense, that announcement shouldn't have mattered. Now, the other hand, one could argue that that announcement for Assad was a way to sort of signal to his enemies, the West is not going to come back you up, and I'm going to prove it by doing a strike and watch how impotent they are against my abilities. Because one would think that if you're hearing the president say we're not going to get involved, why do anything more? I sometimes wonder if we have a U.S.-centric view. I personally can't figure out where that goes. I go back and forth. I really believe that in his mind, this is an acceptable level of barbarity against his enemy, and it was faster than going block by block, and it was messaging to the elements that remain. Now, the U.S. part of it is unclear. I would just point out that the U.S. through its actions had indicated that it wasn't going to do anything for the Assad regime for weeks and weeks and weeks. So, but again, I literally go back and forth because I just can't get past the coincidence of doing it so soon after, as you point out, such a public pronouncement.
So, Nancy, I mean, you are one of the reporters that probably knows the internal workings of the Pentagon better than almost anyone. So I'm sort of curious as what's your perception about how the Pentagon is dealing with the chaos out of the White House? So like literally 20 minutes ago, it was announced that Nadia Shadlow is going to be leaving the National Security Council. She was an architect of the national security strategy that included sort of an articulation on Syria. Is your sense that the military is the military and they're just trudging ahead with sort of strategic aims, and the chaos that's happening at the White House is not particularly disorienting to them? Or do you think that this constant turnover, the lack of sort of clear guidance as opposed to moods and sort of hints about where the president's going, how is the Pentagon responding to that? Are they learning? Kind of, what's your sense of that?
So one of the things I've seen is that Secretary Mattis has been the key point person in terms of contact between the Defense Department and the administration, and he has sort of done that by design. Now, there's a chain of command that allows for that, but I think he's taken particular control in terms of the interactions that happen between the department and the White House, and I think part of that is to mitigate against misunderstandings and confusion. The Pentagon has many, many skills, and one of them is hearing what you want to hear in this face of confusion. And so from their perspective, if there's not an order, then we're okay. I mean, they're looking for orders and guidance, and I think the challenge they have is sort of blocking out the noise. From their perspective, they have had the same cabinet secretary and the same chairman. There is a chain of command that's supposed to buffer against it. I think the real challenge, and where you've seen it, frankly, was in Afghanistan and Syria, because for months and months and months, we didn't have an Afghanistan plan. It took until August of last year while U.S. troops were dying in the field. And so what's the end state you're trying to achieve? It's hard to ask a service member to go overseas without that not being articulated. And again, in Syria, we had this sort of back and forth. I mean, I remember traveling to Kuwait in January, and there was a general just holding up Tillerson's speech on Syria from the month before. He's like, we have a strategy, because there was something finally written down. So what you see is a building sort of grasping for guidance, whatever the guidance is, and they'll follow that order. The other thing I think you see, which for me is a little unsettling and has always been unsettling, is it gives an opportunity for generals, or at least some would argue forces generals, to sort of take a step back. Because how can you engage when it's so unclear? You can, it sort of forces them to stay in their lane and say, we're just following orders. And so in that way, I think it limits the level of discourse that needs to happen about these major decisions. You know, it's not the military, the past would be the military coming forward with four plans that they would have had ready to go because they understood the president's direction. You can feel it on this, that this is a Pentagon sort of scrambling. Okay, this is what the president wants. How do we make it fit? It's kind of, things have been a little topsy-turvy. Now, that said, it's very hard. There is a command and control structure there. People are reticent to criticize. People are reticent. At the height of the frustration, you can still get someone to say, but he's the commander-in-chief, and that means something to them.
And I mean, one sort of sentiment I'm seeing come out of part of sort of the national security establishment is this notion that like Trump is asking the right questions, right? He's breaking the orthodoxy and this is like the one good thing. Is that shared at all in the Pentagon?
So it's funny because you'll talk to people and he's asking sometimes the right questions in that, sometimes you bring somebody new in and they have a fresh perspective. I think the challenge is to then what to do with that information, what the expectation is. You know, why are we still in Afghanistan? Why do we need to stay in Syria? Those are valid questions. But the process, as I've seen it, has been a lot of consternation back and forth, and a Pentagon, frankly, that's able to get him to pick the middle policy, right? We saw this in Afghanistan. You can see the Washington Post had reported this about these different options that they'll spell out. So you see them sort of hearing all his questions, coming up with options, and really sort of catering it towards the middle option, the one that's sort of the least risky. So with the Russia and the diplomats, and which one should be expelled. They gave him, as the Post reported, the small, medium, and large option. And militarily, the same thing happens. They give the small, medium, and large option and basically say, small takes a lot of risk and you would own it if it didn't work out, and big is very costly. Why don't you pick the middle? And that's the kind of thing I see that happens the most often, that they're hearing his questions and somehow guiding through advice and recommendations a moderate approach in the absence of any sort of clear sort of Trump doctrine on national security.
Quinta, last word.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things I was thinking about where you were saying that is that Trump has in many ways, at least in the space of targeted killing or, you know, operations on a sort of on a more pinprick basis, that there's actually, it's been reported that there's some worry in the Pentagon that he's actually devolved too much responsibility toward them, not in terms of tactics or strategy, but just in the sense of
authorities.
Right. And mm-hmm. and being able to say, you know, well, I didn't do that. That wasn't my fault. That Obama was very sort of personally involved and that Trump has been pushing back a little bit and right. that there's a concern that, as he said, when that Navy SEAL died, you know, they lost Ryan. Right. That wasn't me. Is there concern about that here, too?
So I actually think it's a great question. I actually think it was going that way. And where you're starting to see the resistance, I think, is in Niger, because you had a lot of authorities given down to lower levels. And then the October 4th death of those four service members, I think, sort of highlighted the perils of giving so much authority so much lower down without a real proper or in-depth supervision. Now, I will tell you that the Pentagon folks felt micromanaged a lot of times by the Obama administration. So you're right, it could have gone too far. I never heard it as a serious discussion until Niger. And in fact, my colleague Michael Phillips reported today about commanders now being given, they're pushing troops back from front lines and not having them as forward as a reaction. So the push-pull is starting to happen. And the turning point was Niger.
Okay, let's move on to our object lessons. Quinta, you want to go first?
Sure. So Ben and I have a piece in The Atlantic that was actually published a week or so ago, but is unfortunately relevant now, about whether or not we're in a constitutional crisis, which has kind of been a permanent question, at least for me, over the past year or so. And what we concluded is that there's not really a clear definition of constitutional crisis, which makes it kind of hard to answer the question. The better concept might be the idea of what two scholars, John Finn and Jack Balkin, have called constitutional rot, that we're in this sort of situation where the text of the Constitution is there. Everyone is still referring to it as, you know, the authority on what you should do, but the underlying sense of, you know, we the people, the president honoring his oath, is not there. And that Ben actually went a little farther and said, well, maybe it's not constitutional rot, because rot's sort of one way. It's a constitutional infection. Mm. And that the sort of pushback against Trump is an effort to heal. And so the question
like is... Like antibodies.
Exactly. So in this very overstretched metaphor, the question is essentially whether those antibodies are strong enough to push back against the sort of decay that's going on.
Is one of the antibodies just announced that he's not seeking re-election?
I don't know if Paul Ryan is an antibody. Okay. I think Paul Ryan may be part of the infection.
Oh, okay. All right. Nancy, what's your object?
I'm sharing a tweet. Okay. Because we now get enough of those in Washington. This is today from the president. Russia vows to shoot down any and all missiles fired at Syria. Get ready, Russia, because they will be coming, nice and new and quote-unquote smart. You shouldn't be partners with a gas-killing animal who kills his people and enjoys it, exclamation point.
Okay.
And I point this out is because I don't remember a time when the U.S. has declared war, essentially, via tweet, right?
Oh.
Because when you say get ready, Russia, it's hard to understand the scenario in which the U.S. can now push back and say never mind, right? Because we've just
written. He did kind of just like let them know that it's coming, right?
Yeah. And so, as I told you, your military does not talk bad about his commander in chief, but there were a lot of things in here. He says Russia vows to shoot down any and all missiles that fired at Syria. That raises questions about whether a U.S. operation can have manned aircraft. Or do we have to do it because he said it? Or do we have to not do it because of this threat? They're coming nice and new smart weapons. Those are precision-guided weapons, so we're signaling that. And the U.S. Donald Cook is in the region and is now susceptible, arguably, and is expected to be a part of the operation, is vulnerable now, arguably, to harassment from Russian planes and whatnot because of the sort of provocative tweet. And so I just wanted to point it out because I've covered the U.S. military since 2003, and it's the first time I ever went, oh, so that's how we're going to find out about this mission today, the start of it.
Makes reporting easier, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can find, you just roll over in bed and be like, okay.
I thought the whole plan with Trump was to be unpredictable. Okay. Susan, your object.
All right. So my object is both thematic to the episode and thematic to rational security's commitment to log rolling constantly.
Oh, nice.
So mine is a great moment in the Facebook testimony in the Senate yesterday in which Senator Cantwell asked Mark Zuckerberg whether or not he knew what total information awareness
was. This is going to be my object. Oh, my God.
Oh,
thank
no,
you for
I'm
doing it.
Your object.
This is way better for
my
you.
My object.
Bolt upright in my chair.
See, this was not planned. We did not plan
this. We did not plan this.
Rational Witness, security they listeners, did not plan it.
It is all. This is all organic. You're getting the unfiltered approach. So my object lesson, which was maybe going to be Shane's object lesson, is the wonderful book The Watchers by one Shane Harris, which would teach Mark Zuckerberg absolutely everything he could possibly want to know about TIA, total information awareness. Somewhere Poindexter has a big smile on his face.
Guess he never opened a Facebook account.
It can be our joint object lesson.
I love that. No, you totally, that's perfect. That's way better than me like log rolling.
You should mail him a copy.
You know, I did tweet. I tweeted yesterday. Oh, I know what TIA is about. And then I did not tweet it directly at Zuckerberg. I should have, but I tweeted with Zuck Baby some light airplane reading for the ride home. But it was great. It was really something for it. I was just like high fiving Maria Cantwell and like looking at Zuckerberg and being like, how do you not know what total information awareness is?
He's a child.
Then I realized he was probably literally a freshman in college when that happened.
He's in his dorm room. Older than I am, and I know what it is. So
I think he needs to read my book.
But that's because I read your book. So
maybe I'll buy an ad on Facebook to promote it. JK. Oh, that brings us to the end of the podcast. You've made it through again, listeners. Oh, and you're still here. Rational Security is a production of Lawfare. Ben promised that our show page would be migrating at some point. Maybe that's why he's really not here. Maybe he's out there taking care of our show page. I kind of doubt it. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. You can find us on Facebook. We are still on Facebook. Facebook is still free. You can find it there. You can find us on your favorite podcasting service. When you do download the podcast, please make sure to leave a rating and review. We really appreciate it. Helps us out. It's much, much appreciated. Our audio engineer this week is Matthew Kahn. Show is edited and produced by Jen Patia Howell. Music this week by Michael Cohen and the Canary Quartet. No, it's not quite
okay.
Right.
Okay.
Canary. What could go with canary? The Loyal Canary? The Midtown Canary?
Chorus.
The what?
The Canary Chorus.
Canary Chorus. Michael Cohen and the Canaries. I don't know. It's not working for me.
The point is he's going to sing.
The point is he's going to sing like a canary. And it's going to be a compelling song indeed. And if he does sing like a canary, Sophia Yan will happily do backup. She would definitely play backup if he wanted to like flip and give some testimony.
Yeah, and set to like a nice
pop. Nice mood music for your interview with Bob Mueller. She'll be happy to be there for you. Let us know. We can make that available. On behalf of my friend Susan Hennessy and our special guests Quint Dresick and Nancy Youssef, I'm Shane Harris. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.